Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. I am thrilled to have a special episode tonight, which is actually the first time we've really done a live recording in front of an audience. The evening was Friday, May 8th, at the home of Mark and Elizabeth England in Salt Lake City, Utah. The event was the Faith Again Gathering, which is a monthly group that gets together, usually at the England's home, sometimes at another one. And discusses, usually has a speaker or some kind of panel and discusses wonderful things. The particular conversation that you're about to hear came together with Chelsea Shield Strayer, who's been on Mormon Matters quite a few times and is well known as a contributor to other podcasts and things like this. She wrote to Jay Griffith, who organizes many of the Faith Again evenings, and me also to say, you know, I have wonderful parents. We've been in a dialogue for about 10 years together
about my faith journey.
They're very conservative. They have, you know, very traditional Mormon worldviews, but they're super articulate. And we've struggled and we've wrestled, and yet we've maintained a great relationship through it all. And I think it would just be a great evening if I can get them to be willing to chat and for us just to kind of talk about our journeys together. Jay and I both thought it was a wonderful thing, and it just couldn't have turned out better. I'm so grateful to have Sarah Collette as the partner on this. Many of you will know her from a Thoughtful Faith podcast she hosted off and on for years there. She had wonderful equipment that was able to pick up Chelsea along with her parents and me. We were in the front of the room, and when we went to Q&A, we ended up having to go with some digital recorders. So you'll notice a little bit of unevenness during that section in terms of the recorder was different, and some people held it closer to their mouths than others. We did what we could a little bit in post-production, but it wasn't always able to be fully evened out. But I think you'll pick up everything. I know you'll enjoy this one. So let's go for it. This is the evening of the 8th Faith Again. Chelsea Shield Strayer and her parents, Eric and Heidi Shields.
Welcome, everybody. We're so grateful that you're here. As I've been thinking about the conversation that we're going to have tonight, it occurred to me that though we're going to talk about some very specific things in the conversational life between these people, really more than anything else, we're focusing on relationships. And I know a lot of us, when we're in these modes where we're in a faith transition or something comes along and we're having to shift our perspectives or something like that, you know, one of the things that we often will say is, remember, relationships are first. Beliefs and things like this, worldview and the challenges of those things, yeah, that's tough stuff. But we always want to love first. And so I think what the most wonderful thing that we have going tonight is this is a family who's truly making relationship work. You know what I mean? In other words, for 10 or 11 years now, they've been having a conversation that they're going to tell you about. They'll be modeling what it means to say, I choose you primarily and above everything else. And we know that relationships are hard. And we know that in some ways, you know, when you do that marry you for better or worse, or when you have a child or something like that, it's kind of easy if there were a physical issue, you know, or financial crisis or stuff like that. In some ways, it's easier to kind of rally and pull together in that. But man, when it comes to religion, that's heavy trip stuff, isn't it? That's worldview. This is like my basic lens through looking at the world is changing here. And it can feel very, very threatening. It can feel very, very, you know, scary. And there's a vulnerability in every good relationship. And it means I'm in danger of being changed by you. If we go there in religion, you know, I just may end up having to do all the rethinking and stuff that doesn't look fun. You know, if I'm not the one who initiated this conversation, right, it doesn't look that fun to talk with a person who has lost language and who is no longer able to kind of really always say what they believe the way they could when they were able to stand up and testify in the past. And so it doesn't look fun, but that relationship is that willing to be vulnerable. I was thinking, or somebody introduced me to that, you know, the Leonard Cohen song, Hallelujah? I saw your flag on the marble arch. Love is not a big march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. And so that idea of we're joyful in relationship. We have the hallelujah, but there's difficulty here. And so I'm just so grateful to have Chelsea Shields Strayer, Heidi Strayer, Eric Strayer. Heidi Shields. Oh, sorry. Hello.
Okay.
And Eric Shields with us tonight to kind of share a little bit about the story of their family, the story of what's been going on. So I'm mostly going to have them do the talking, a little bit of more introduction between us at the end, and then we'll definitely have time for everybody here to share. So, Chelsea, can I start with, or Eric, I guess we're going to go with you first. The basic background of your family, the history of the church, your family and the church, et cetera, pioneer ancestors, all that
sure.
good stuff.
Can I just say real quick
sure.
kind of why this even came about? So, like you said, I've been kind of going through this faith transition for about a decade now, and over the course of that time, you know, all of us here in a lot of these online communities, in a lot of these activist organizations or blogs or groups, we've seen people come, we've seen them leave, we've seen them leapfrog over us, right? From being like, no, stay in the church, I'm out. You know, we've seen like these incredible changes in the makeup of how the church treats LGBT members. Like, we've seen these incredible things, how we talk about history, how we talk about our past. So in the past decade, a lot has happened in the course of the church and relationship building. And one thing that I've seen that I haven't seen addressed as much on the blogs is this idea of, I feel like, and this is my own idea, but there's a new version of part member families. It's no longer the wife going to church and the husband at home. We now have just an enormous amount of generational part member families where the parents are still active and the kids have gone. And we don't have any tools for that. And the way we treat part member families in the church is quite different than the way we treat kids who have left, right? Or kids who are struggling. And so I've seen failures on the part of parents, but I've seen failures on the part of the kid leaving as well, to communicate, to try to be respectful, to create boundaries or talk about your real journey and your real thoughts without attacking someone else, right? Or saying that mine's the right way. So through the course of this decade, I've seen this terrible thing happen. And at the same time in my personal life, been going through it and trying to figure it out. And we don't have the answers. Like, when I ask my parents to do that, they're like, why us? We don't know what we're doing. And we've made failures along the way. And I think that that's what makes an interesting story is when this happened, I felt this and they felt this. And we can talk about it. And so part of, we're not out of the woods yet. We have a whole nother decade where it's going to be really hard. It's, you know, and we'll talk about that. But I think that, this is just a story that people want to hear, and people have been asking, well, how do your parents deal with ordained women, you know? And how do your parents deal with it? And so people are asking these questions, and the second we said this was happening, I mean, there were so many comments, so many posts, oh, we need this. So I'm hoping that if nothing else, it makes our relationship stronger. And thank you for letting us do it. And maybe a handful of others don't have to fall into the years of antagonism before they get to the years of healthy, and maybe that will be good for some. So that's kind of why I wanted to do this. The way the format is, we're going to just talk a little bit about our background, just so you know where we're coming from, what kind of stock we come from. And Dad's going to kind of talk about that a little bit, just so you kind of understand the framework of how a paradigm is created, how our worldview is created, and how strongly it's rooted. And my mom's going to talk a little bit about our own personal family. We've had some great highs, and we've had some really low lows. And she's going to kind of go over our own family personal history, just so you know where our background is. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about, okay, well, how long has this been going on? What's going on? And then I've just reserved time for each one of us to kind of tell our story. Like, this is what it felt like when this thing happened. And if nothing else, I think it's good for someone like me to take the time to listen, and vice versa. And then at the end, we have some questions, but really, I want it to be interactive after that, and Dan will kind of moderate throughout. So that's kind of the plan. Good?
Awesome.
Great. So probably 13 of my 16 great-great-grandparents came across the plains. So huge pioneer ancestry. They were sent out to Twila by Brigham Young. My dad grew up in Twila on the other side of the tracks. That's where he learned his language. And hell and damn was not a swear word to him. Great, great man. Nobody in his family had gone on a mission. When he was 24, 25, the stake president called him in to go on a mission. And he said, I'll help pay the way. And so he did. Changed his life. He was sent to the New England States Mission, and that's where he really got his testimony and came home and changed who he married, changed what he did for a vocation. And so that's kind of a foundation for me. He ended up teaching seminary and teaching religion at BYU. I remember growing up in Provo there. I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'm going to say it. One of my cousins brought a non-member friend to a cheerleading camp at BYU. And I remember looking at her in the living room thinking, how could you not be a Mormon? I still remember that thought. Now I laugh at that and I think, wow. I was so sheltered. I knew of two non-members in junior high, Doug Crable and Tim Spence. They acted like Mormons. They just, you know, I just heard they were non-Mormons. So sheltered. Bald like a baby when I went on my mission. I'm in the middle of nine children, and all eight of them served missions. The one girl got married before. So just, you know, that kind of family. And on my mission is where I wondered if I really knew the church was true. I've always been a believer, not a believer. A believer. Sorry, I have to throw those jokes in there.
He teaches seminary, so he has to kind of...
In our family, we call it religious Tourette's. And I'll just say real quick, so sometimes he just can't help himself, so someone will walk out with a little bit of short shorts, or like, or you know, one time he saw one of the sons-in-law with a beard, and we were walking to church. But you didn't shave. We're like, Dad, don't worry. That's just his religious Tourette's. Like, he can't help it.
Anyway, in the scriptures, there's the gifts of the Spirit. Some know and some believe on their words. And I really believe that was my gift. I've just always believed. And so no big crisis of faith. On my mission, I came to own it, where I realized I knew the church was true. I always knew the church was true. I just didn't know that I knew it. And some youth relate to that. Came home and decided to follow my dad and taught seminary and had a great experience. I was able to live in Oregon and live in California, and so came to know of many good people of other faiths, and I'm not so sheltered anymore. And along the way, we had eight children and have loved all of them. And then now we're kind of, let's see, I was going to say something else, but that's kind of my journey. Yeah. So I guess.
Okay, thanks. And well, do you want to say that you're a CES?
Oh, yes. Now, so. Yeah, so I teach seminary at UCAS, Utah County Academy of Science. Three classes of seminary in the morning, then I get to teach institute at UVU, Orem Institute in the afternoon. I also was going to say, this is the only time I've never written a note, because I didn't know what to write. I don't know what I've done. The word that describes Heidi and I is muddle. We muddle. You don't even know what that means? Do we use that anymore? We just muddle through. We're not goal makers. We're not any of this. We just kind of muddle. And so, you know, if there's anything we can help with tonight, we'd love to.
Okay, I have a little bit of different background. My dad was a member. None of my stock, as far as I know, are pioneer stock. My dad's father was like the first branch president back in Missouri. And so my dad was raised as a member of the church. My mom was a convert and didn't join the church till many years into their marriage. But my dad was always really faithful, and I was the youngest of six, and so I was always raised in the church. So I was born in the church and a member of the church my whole life. I would have to say I'm like Eric. I just have it's easy for me to believe. Not that I don't ever question, but it's easy for me to just do what I think I'm supposed to do. And so I don't really have a lot of questions on things. But we raised eight kids. We had two boys and six girls. And through the course of that, we've definitely had ups and downs and learned a lot of things through trial and error. As much error as anything else. So anyway, that's kind of my background.
So I have to say I was a little bit like my dad, sheltered. My grandma, when we learned that she wasn't Mormon when they got married, I remember us asking my grandma, like, my grandfather, why would you marry a non-Mormon? You know, because we'd just been taught our whole lives, and his response was my favorite thing ever. He goes, We lived in Missouri. The only other Mormon girl I knew had hair on her chest. So we always just imagined this girl with, like, hair on her chest. And, like, my grandma was this beautiful woman. So we always laughed about that. But one thing about this, just this background part, is one of the things that converted my grandmother was she lost a daughter. And that was a big moment for her that the church rallied around and, you know, during comforting that great loss. And she also lost a son in a tragic accident. So death was something that gave her a lot of comfort, that was able to kind of, and she was faithful till the day she died. I mean, she was very believing. And we had a similar thing happen in our family a couple times. We had an aunt that died in a tragic death, and we had a son. When I was 17, he was 15. He's the third oldest. He drowned in an accident. And that was another thing in our family that was quite a moment. It's kind of like that game where everything just shakes up when someone dies in your family, and you just have to figure out the new normal. And that was a big moment for all of us, kind of in faith, trying to figure out what that meant and how to make sense of it, and especially with an accident. And so anyway, that's kind of our background. And then I just wanted us to kind of tell our stories more, not things that happen, but feelings. And, you know, I hope I don't talk too long. So we can cut in here, and maybe that's what we'll do, is like, here's, at this point, what did you think, or something like that. So the one thing I want maybe parents of kids who leave to understand a little bit is that just the genuine pain of the journey of your worldview, the ground underneath you falling apart, crashing apart, everything you knew. And maybe this will make sense after I tell my story, but just to kind of preface it, it's, I always worry that people think I'm trying to lead them astray, or that I'm trying to convince them, or I worry that people think I'm trying to sin, you know, or whatever. And we get these worries because these are things we've heard for the last 3 decades. For 30 years I've heard, oh, well, that's not really why she got excommunicated. Or, I can't believe that that woman would leave the church. She's ruined her kids for life. And so we grow up, even as faithful young kids, we still hear all of this stuff. And it doesn't matter what your journey is. If you've heard these negative things, when it comes time for you to really look yourself in the mirror, that's what you're saying to yourself. Am I going to damn my daughter for a lifetime of hell? Am I a bad person? Am I trying to sin? And you're asking yourself these questions. And so even if people do respond well, you're still believing these things. And so that's kind of the first part of my journey. I clearly had, and I don't want to talk about specifics. I think this could get bogged down in, well, this one historical fact, or I want to kind of do a higher level. And so I did have issues, you know, in high school after Grant's death, of really questioning certain things. But where I really had my first moment of a faith transition was actually in college. I was an anthropology major going to graduate school. I loved anthropology. I loved traveling the world, understanding new cultures. I'd lived in Africa for years. And I actually studied West African indigenous religion and spirit possession and healing. And as a young Mormon white BYU girl, you know, like with my backpack on in the village, you know, it was quite a shocking culture shock. And I had to definitely ask all those questions, like, and kind of check my ethnocentrism, which is, well, of course witchcraft doesn't exist. Because, I mean, come on. And yet people were living and dying on these belief systems. And so it really took kind of, you know, your anthropological, like, stripes to really work my way around my own paradigm to get to a point where I'm like, it doesn't matter what I think. They believe this thing so much. It alters their entire worldview, the decisions they make, their health. If someone curses them, they literally fall ill because they believe it so strongly. And so that was a big journey for me. But guess what happens when I go back to BYU? And I start understanding, well, maybe religion is just a social structure that keeps the world, you know, all these like academic things. And I remember asking my dad about it. And up until this point, we had had, I'm trying to keep everyone anonymous, but we had had a relative that had left the church, only one of like 9 kids, and each of them having 7 kids, and on the other side 5 kids, and each of them having 7, you know, only kid who had left the church. And I remember talking to my dad about it, and his response at the time, me being faithful, was, oh, he knows better. He was raised right. He knows better. He's just doing this to sin. Okay.
And so as I'm approaching my dad with these really serious intellectual questions and doubts, I'm thinking, this is how he's going to respond to me. I'm preparing myself for, but how does that work? You know, and asking the questions that you ask in college to my religion professors, but explain polygamy again. Like, all these hard things are starting to hit your testimony. And especially our generation. I was raised in the generation where we had a whitewashed history, like, oh, don't plant a seed of doubt. Well, 30 years later, it's all coming to fruition where we feel a lot of betrayal, right? So this is all hitting. And other generations have different experiences. But so I'm starting to ask these questions while still feeling that just in asking, I'm sinning somehow. And I don't know if you remember that day at BYU. I'm reading the scriptures a half an hour a day, saying my prayers. I was one of those girls. Didn't kiss till I was 19. Like, kept every rule, you know. And I just said, I don't know if I believe. And I expected, I kind of prepared myself, like, hunched shoulders, prepared for a whiplash. And he shocked me. Do you remember what you said? What did you say?
Just something about the Book of Mormon. I don't know. The first thing, but...
Sorry. You just kind of said, well, yeah, that's hard. And I was like, whoa! I was just blown away. And then, you know, said, well, here's how I gained my testimony. Here's, this is the bedrock of our religion. If you can believe in Joseph Smith, if you can believe in, then everything falls into place. And it was, you know, a very didactic kind of conversation. But I was just blown away, like, oh, he doesn't hate me. Like, it's okay to question, you know. And I had the same experience back then. I was, of course, saying my prayers, reading my scriptures. And I felt the same kind of feeling from, at the time, what I thought, Heavenly Father, which was, he's not mad that I'm asking. You know, I'm not doing anything wrong. And so having those two confirmations just felt incredible, you know, for the start of my faith transition, even though, you know, things change. But anyway, so I was shocked by that. And I just wanted, the only point of telling that long story is to just kind of understand that when a kid actually comes to you with something hard, whether it's, Mom, I think I'm gay, or I don't know if I believe, or I, you know, whatever it is, I might be a feminist. Yeah, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
The
F word. They're coming at it with a backpack full of all the negative things that have ever been said about that type of person. And so when I've encountered people before that have reacted harshly about faith transition, they're approaching it from, this is really scary, I got to keep it. Push them on the right path or else they're going to fall off forever. And they're thinking at it from, like, I got to maintain this thing that might be dangerous. It's like a boundary maintenance type of reaction. And that's very natural in all cultures. But I think it's important to understand that the person coming to you is coming at it with so much self-recrimination. What's that word?
Recrimination.
That they already are loaded down. You know, and so maybe keep that in mind. So that was kind of the first part. Do you guys want to say anything about back then? Having kids that question, you're just like, oh, she'll be fine. She'll just read her scriptures more or whatever.
No, I thought it was, you know, more serious than that. But my bedrock is the Book of Mormon. So I think I talked to you about the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon's true. Joseph Smith was a prophet. Yeah.
So, my experience was, and I've brought this up to Chelsea in recent times too, is that Chelsea, when she was 12 years old, we watched a thing, Roots. We watched Roots together as a family, and that kind of set her on her path to wanting to go to Africa and do some of these things. And when she was that age, she bore a really strong testimony to me. And she said, I absolutely know the church is true. And at that time, that was truth for her. And now that is not necessarily truth for her, but I do call her on it when she'll say, you know, I've never had a testimony. I said, you might not have a testimony now, but you did then. You did then, because you bore it to me and it was true then. It has changed and you've lost some of that. But there was a time when you did have a testimony. And she said, yeah, you're right about that. So, I mean, we've kind of gone through this transition, and things have changed as she's learned more and done more. But she did have a strong will and a strong desire to find out and all those things at a very young age.
Well, and that is something we could talk about maybe in the discussion part, is a 12-year-old testimony. You know, I look at it now and I think, oh, a 12-year-old doesn't know anything. They're so little, right? Like,
I would believe, you know, I'm going to marry, you know, at the time it was Prince William. Like, you know, maybe it's like Justin Bieber. I mean, you just are so impressionable and so you just, and I look at my little 12-year-old self and think, I just wanted to be loved. I wanted to be perfect. I wanted people to think I was good. And being good meant being a good Mormon, you know? But at the same time, I don't want to belittle that I did have spiritual experience and I did feel strongly. So that's something maybe we could talk about in a little bit. Just as I continued the journey, I went to graduate school, and what we ended up in that conversation, which I think is important, because I've gotten since a lot of hate letters. I've gotten from ordained women to family to leaving the church, a lot of these, you know, 7-page letters of you're following Satan, you are a bad person, emails, things sent to my home from my ward members. You know, this is back, not now, but back in the day. So as I received these letters, one of the number one things they say is, if you just read the scriptures, if you just prayed, why are you too hard-hearted? Why won't you try? And so what I want to just clarify in this moment is, after this, I thought, you know, I have all these doubts. The logical solution is not, I have all these doubts, see ya. Like, the logical solution is, I have all these doubts, I better figure it out. I better pray harder. I better read harder. I better, you know, invest more. And I, you know, I could show you the Book of Mormons just shredded with lines and letters and memorized all the scriptures. And I became a scriptorian to the point where in years later, my mom and I would debate things. And she's like, I don't need to know all that. I just believe. And I'm like, no, look at here. Let's figure it out, you know. So I did invest harder when I doubted. And so what's hard now as, like, leaving the church is the assumption is I never did that. And I think a lot of kids feel that way. The assumption is that if you just keep reading. And so my question, you know, maybe for the discussion is, for how long? How long? Was 2 years enough? I've done it for 10. Do I just keep reading and just keep praying and that's the only solution? That's the only end goal? Is there no other end goal? And so that is another thing kids come prepared with is, I did what you said. You know, no, I really genuinely read and studied. And so it's hard for me now to get that assumption. So the next part of my journey, and I think a couple people can relate to this, was I actually watched Jonestown documentary in graduate school. And I remember watching it and it being so lovely at the beginning. And be like, oh, the first integrated religion. They're such a great religion. This is awesome. Oh, my goodness. What just happened? Right? And you're watching this documentary. Like, how can something so good be so bad? And so that just shook me to my core. And it made me think, well, how do you know if a religion's bad? How do you know when that point is that it goes from being tolerant, loving, desegregated to being drinking Kool-Aid? And so what I created is a boundary for myself. We learn this in Young Women's, right? Create a boundary beforehand so you know and you don't, you know, make the decision in the moment. So and that boundary was, for me, in understanding the history of Steve Jones, was when a leader does things that he asks others not to do, or vice versa. When he has allowed rules that other people aren't doing. That to me was the moment when I started doubting him. And I'm like, that's not a true prophet. Then comes all my historical meanderings through church history. Okay? And so this is kind of the downward spiral. And we won't get into much detail, but I just start reading and reading and reading and reading and reading and reading and reading. And the answer from a lot of people, maybe we can take a break and you guys could talk here, was be careful of learning. Don't read too much. Be careful. Don't think you're too learned. I was in grad school. I was one of the only women I knew ever, you know, I didn't have any aunts or grandmas, or never knew another woman in grad school. And so I got a lot of this, be careful, don't learn too much. Don't think you're better. So I was kind of on this balance of like, okay, well, but if it's true, anything you learn will just confirm that, right? So it's just a very confusing thing when you're learning to be critical thinking in grad school. So anyway, I remember that being hard as I'm going through all this history, trying to avoid anything anti-Mormon, but the internet's breaking now. So now it's like, what's anti-Mormon, what's not? And just all this knowledge is coming at the same time. I don't know that we had, I remember Dad and I sitting in his seminary, like going through some of these things verbatim. And I remember one poignant moment, and then I'll see what you said, was polygamy was a big issue for me. And Dad and I wrote one of my final papers on polygamy. And an apologist paper about the highest degrees of celestial kingdom. And I thought it was so fascinating. Like, look, we're so smart. Because, instead of the 3 degrees being highest, middle, and lowest, we said, what if it's female and male and then married? Because it's separate single servants. I'm like, that's why you have to have polygamy. Because what if really faithful girls just never got married, right? It's just rationalizing everything. And at this point, even writing this in depth paper on polygamy, still never being told that Joseph actually was married, that actually had sex with these women. And so in our conversations years later, I remember saying to him, I feel lied to. I feel betrayed. And on top of that, the very people you're now asking me to trust are the people who I feel kept information and told me lies. So that was a period for a while of us being in this space, and it created a lot of tension.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I remember that discussion, and she said something was very offensive to me about Joseph Smith and young brides, and I won't say it, but, and so I have the defense up, and I'm going to defend him, and, I don't know how I answered you, but...
Had you been aware that he had pluralized? Oh, yeah. Okay, you had.
Yeah, and polyandry and all that stuff. Yeah, I don't know. To me, I put some things on a shelf and still know that he was a prophet of God. And I know we don't want to go into the particulars of polygamy, but the relationship, I forgot to say this earlier, a mantra, something that rolls through my head, is a statement that my father said in every prayer I ever heard him pray. Bless us to live so that we can return and live together as a family in the highest part of the celestial kingdom. Remember that? This is a granddaughter here. Uh-huh. And so, boy, talk about church and family. Boy, that's right there. And so, seeing a daughter that's maybe going to leave, well, wait, we got to be together in the highest part. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from, and as I see her struggling with these things. And so it's hard.
And in your brain, are you thinking she's just misled or something, or was it more of a personal, like the personal loss was felt more than... how you were imagining what was going on in Chelsea's own mind?
Yeah, that's a great question. Probably not the personal loss yet, okay. And still not. I have great hopes. We're going to be together. The Joseph Smith promise. We can get that if you want.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I still have a lot of hope. And
so, Heidi, did it ever feel like a personal rejection to you? Like, what we've thought about, what was good enough for my family... not good enough for her, and it's kind of a personal thing?
No, because Chelsea was always very well-read and researched out things. And so, I knew that she just had her own questions, and I knew that she and I just went at things differently. Like, I can look as a mother at the early days of the church. I can hear mistakes that were made, and I can look at it and think, as a mom, with never having had kids on my first few kids, which Chelsea's number two, then, you make mistakes because there's not a manual that tells you how to do it. You're doing the best you can. You're trying to, you love your children. You want what's best for them, and still you make mistakes. So I kind of look at the early days of the church history in a similar vein. For me, it's not that I bury my head in the sand and don't think there weren't mistakes made. I just look at them and think, although the doctrine is divine, humans, Joseph Smith among them, were starting a new church of which there was no playbook. There was no manual, just like having a baby when you've never had one before. They had to learn everything on the fly, and even when mistakes were made, then they finally asked and got some communication on some issues. So I felt that did not shake my faith at all, the fact that mistakes were made, or make me feel like Joseph Smith was less of a prophet, because I can look at it and just say, He is a prophet, but he is also a person. And not only that, he was only 14 when this started. And an unlearned person. So even though he was, I feel like he was the appointed prophet and divine, it didn't make me question. Whereas with Chelsea, she looks at things in a different scope than I do. So I didn't take it personally because I knew that that's her nature. And her nature is different than my nature.
Well, and I have two questions, follows up, that I think people would like to hear. The first one is with Dad, and just think about it maybe, and I'll talk to Mom first, which is, how do you feel about the kid who thinks, but you lied to me? And I want to know how you feel that as a CES person, as a dad, because I, not necessarily just you, but I asked my church leaders. I was one of those inquisitive kids, and I was blatantly lied to from leaders in the church, so...
Leaders that you're sure knew,
yeah,
the stuff
that I did know they knew. Yeah. And so, okay. And I know there's a way to both of us reconcile that, but I would just like to hear what he says and then with my mom after this comment. I want to hear what she says. So one of these conversations was during Prop 8. And it was kind of the first activist stance I took a little bit away from the church, even though I was still trying really hard to stay in. And we had a big conversation, and I think this will be interesting for parents and kids, which was at the end of this conversation, I was debating, like, legal matter, and I was putting all these, like, very rational arguments and political arguments out there. And at the end of the conversation, you know, and she was saying things as well about believing in church and God, and we both left that conversation heated, angry. I think we stayed up to, like, 3 a.m., you know? And she was feeling, and we talked about this later, felt like you thought I was stupid. I felt, and maybe put it in your own words, and I was leaving the conversation saying, I felt like you thought I was bad. Like I was faithless. Like I wasn't worthy or a good person. And so we're having this debate, and what we're communicating to each other, we're just on totally different planes. As we were trying to make each other see each other's point, basically. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. And it's, that's a hard, I mean, that it was a hard issue to even explain then and is still now, you know, I would try to talk to Chelsea and my son-in-law and say, you know, in every legal way, I had no problem with the gay position, and I had gay friends, and I loved gay people, and they had their right to have their lifestyle. I didn't have a problem with any element of that, but I did have a problem with the term marriage, not like legal union, but the term marriage from what I had believed and what I felt. And in California, where we were asked by our church leaders to support both financially and time wise the Prop 8 position, and I felt very strongly that you know, I should do that. And I did that. And so that was hard between me and Chelsea. And yet, you know, I tried to explain it wasn't that I had these bad feelings. It was just that on the term marriage and on that position, I feel like this is an important thing. And we did have this interaction of me feeling like she's trying to tell me all these things and me feeling stupid about it, and her feeling like me saying I go by faith and we was asked to do this and I'm going to do what I've been asked to do, and her feeling like, well, then you're saying that I'm a bad person, that I don't do these things. So,
and a follow-up to that is, so we had similar conversations, and just while we're on this vein before I move on, about she was a stake camp director. And then maybe this just gets people to understand the mindsets of both. And the stake president said, you know, if girls wear, you know, don't cover their shoulders, they're not supposed to be at camp or whatever. And she told the story, but she needed to send a girl home. And I was livid. I was just, there is a teenage girl who chooses to go to a church camp in the summer. She could be doing anything. And she's choosing church. And the humiliation of being sent home because you're short, you know, just that, what must that little girl be feeling? And just, I was just livid that the pain that girl must have gone through and all this stuff. And my mom was thinking at it of, I'm supposed to follow my leaders. That is my job. If that was a bad call, that's on the stake president. And, you know, we were having this conversation again, obedience, maybe it's letter of the law, spirit of the law, obedience. I don't know what the other word is. And we kept running into these same things. And the difference between now and then is I think at the time we were both trying to convince each other that we were right. And I think that's why we left with so much angst after all of those conversations.
Whereas I feel like now we more just choose to agree to disagree. You know, just kind of love each other and just, you know, you can think what you want and I'm going to think what I want. So we don't really necessarily try to convince each other to come around, but we just, yeah. You know.
And are you better at saying, I'm picking up a whiff of I'm bad, and now you're able to name it?
Is that a, not really, because not? I just don't feel like there is, I
you
feel like for years there
anymore.
Has not been okay. That. So I just feel like, you know, I can just, you know, like the ordained women, those things have all been in the recent years. I have not in any way felt neither offended by that or felt bad about Chelsea for that. I simply have thought, you know, she's her own person and she's got to do what she's got to do. And she has in no way tried to push that on me because, you know, if she asked me point blank, what do you think about this? I'll say,
I disagree. For me, I don't feel the need for that, but obviously for you, you do. So, I mean, I can look at it that way.
But it sounds like it was an important moment to name. You think I'm stupid. You think I'm bad.
Yes.
And
yes.
Once you can kind of name that, then you can deal with it and almost move past it. Good, good. Well, she threw you a tough one, Eric.
No, I agree that we parents or seminary institute teachers were kind of told, warned, don't sow seeds of doubt. I'll tell you, experience my first year teaching DNC church history. I had a senior class, and so I felt like I could do a little more. And so I mentioned that Joseph Smith was married to more than one wife and, you know, brought some things up. And I had a kid make a pretty caustic comment. No. And I was really nervous. And so at the end of the class, two kids, one guy and one girl, very good friends, were bawling. They were crying. They stayed after class, and this is so unsettling. And I don't know what to do. I thought, man, have I done wrong? Later, the boy came back and told me what happened. I never found out when the girl. And so I wonder if I did wrong, if I told too much. He went home. He left school. It was like second or third period. He went home, drove home, opened up section 132, and began reading it. And he said the Spirit washed over him. He didn't understand it in his head, but he knew it was true. Wiped up his tears, closed the book, went back to school. Don't know what happened to the girl. Never have heard. You know, what happened to her? And did she leave the church because I taught that lesson? The church has come a long way since then as far as... And I had a daughter who came home from her junior year at UVU. We happened to get into discussion about polygamy, and she says, well, Joseph Smith didn't have more than one wife. I thought, man, how did she get out of my house thinking that? But, you know, so we had a little discussion there. Anyway, so a fine line of don't sow seeds of doubt and yet inoculate. I should share that in the last 3 or 4 years at almost every in-service meeting I've gone to, inoculation has come up. You got to tell them enough so that when they get out there on the internet, they're not freaked out. They're not lied to. My lesson Monday is Mountain Meadows Massacre. For the first time, it's a whole page, two pages, in the seminary manual. It's never been in there before.
And they're doing multiple accounts of the first vision now. That's in the curriculum now.
In fact, the church newsroom has all these articles, right? I heard somebody says, little did I know that the test of my faith was going to come from the church.
No.
As members are coming to read these things, and wow, I didn't know that. And so a fine line of not sowing seeds of doubt and yet telling what happened and dealing with these things, struggling with these things. So I don't know if that's what you wanted.
Okay. Do you have a little more to drive your section of it? Otherwise, we'll just turn to Heidi just to say whatever she wants about this last 10 years.
Absolutely. Let me just finish the story, I guess. So my story kind of was, you know, doubt in all the history rooted out of real things that happened. And I think that's the key I want to just get across is it wasn't me trying to find fault. It wasn't me not doing my work. It was real things. I gave a testimony at the Johnson Farm. We went back east as a family. These great sister missionaries like bore this testimony. And I just felt, you know, it was just such an emotional, you know, the twins who died because the door was open and he got tarred and feathered. I mean, it was just, if I look back, that was such a bedrock moment of like, this is why I believe. They wouldn't tar and feather. I mean, if a 14-year-old boy came to me, I'd be like, you're crazy. And I'd move on with my day, you know? So for them to tar and feather him meant that it was true. And it was just such a bedrock of my testimony. And as I read things, I found out a whole different version of the Johnson Farm, okay? And it makes more sense now why someone would want to tar and feather him or actually castrate him. So it kind of makes more sense. And without getting into details, I begin to feel like I need to have to re-question every testimony that I've built over the course of these years because I built them on false premises. And so me kind of questioning the church was not out of any desire for it not to be true. In fact, it's way worse for me to find out it's not. I wanted it to be. And so that's kind of the end of my story. It's just kind of talking about how these last couple years were me trying to make it work, trying to make it work. And I tried to explain it to my dad when it's just like, well, just believe more. Just read more. Is it's bailing, you know, a bucket that has so many holes in it that the water is just hemorrhaging. And it doesn't matter how many patches I put on, it just can't retain any water. And so for years it went, well, you know, put it on the shelf. Maybe I just don't believe. Maybe I'm one of those, the gifts of the Spirit. And we had an experience in our family where our sister, we have weird experiences, by the way, fell off a zip line, broke all her bones, basically. And she's lying in bed, you know, can't move. And my mom and her are both kind of taking care of her. And her pain medicine kind of made her throw up, and no critique on my mom because she'd been with her for, you know, weeks doing this all by herself. But my mom's like, oh, why'd you throw up again? You know, like, kind of giving her a hard time. And I just remember feeling like, oh, Kams, I'm so sorry. And I kind of sat with her. And again, this is a really flawed story because I was a young girl and I didn't have to do all the hard work. And now that I understand the hard work of being a mom, like, this is a bad story. But what it taught me was, maybe I don't have her gift of belief. Maybe that will just never be something I have. But I have a gift of empathy. And I could see this young girl with her sleeveless getting kicked out. And I could see Prop 8. And I can see, and all I care about is that someone's being hurt. That's all I care about. And that's what I want to solve. And maybe I'll never believe in Jesus Christ or God the way other people do. And maybe that's okay. And what I can contribute is empathy, right? And that made me feel confident in being a member of the church, even if I didn't believe. So I kind of could take all that history stuff, put it on the shelf. And so what I did over the course of the last 5 years is, if I could just help people, if I can make it better, can we make it better for the kids that are struggling, who are committing suicide, for these girls who, like, never figure out their own lives, who are manipulated by, you know, leaders or men, or just, it's really hard to be a young girl in a church, and we get that for a whole other podcast, but anyways, so for the last 5 years, I've focused on, well, maybe I don't believe, but I can make it better, and then, you know, you get burned out after a while of that, and it gets to the point, and this is where we're at now, which, and Dad and I, this will be funny for everyone, we taught gospel doctrine last year, and he taught one day, and I taught the next day, and so the class kind of had these very, my lessons were only, what is the kernel of truth, and we would sit and talk, like, I can't teach this lesson, it was the Bible, but I would find the lessons where I could find a kernel of, like, love one another, be kind, don't be dumb. Like, be nice to people and don't hurt them. And, like, welcome everyone, you know? So I would find these lessons and just, that's all I would try to teach, you know? And he would teach the other stuff. Or I would find some cultural lesson as an anthropologist and, like, talk about the culture at the time or something. And so for years, this is how I stayed. And it got to the point where I was harming myself. And I think a lot of kids who leave, and this is how I'll finish my journey, is that I was having to cut off, I think of like a chiseler, the best parts of myself to stay in this religion. The things that made me, that I felt were my biggest gifts, my biggest qualities, for me to stay, for me to be loved, for me to be liked, for me to be Mormon, I had to just cut it off. And I became the shell of myself that I didn't like, that I didn't relate to, that didn't feel passion, that wasn't being honest with myself. And this is years after not believing, and I'm still wearing my garments, I'm still keeping every commandment, because you know what? I was terrified that one person in a room would say, you only left the church because you wanted to sin. So here I am keeping every rule for 32 years just out of fear, because I wanted to be loved and I wanted to be liked. And so my journey from that day forward is to start making choices that I actually believe, to stop giving people veto power over the choices that I have in my life, to say, well, why do I wear garments? You know, why do I keep this particular rule? And to start evaluating every little rule in my life to make sure it's something that, for me, for who I am versus that. And so that's kind of the end of my journey, is going through that process. And just moving forward, it's going to get harder. And I think people will relate. It's going to get harder as I date. It's going to get harder when they see me wear, you know, sleeveless. It's going to get harder when I make lifestyle choices that they don't like. And it's already hard. And I want people to understand that as I make choices, I don't just make them, I want to do this, so I'm going to do it. I literally think in my parents' minds, they literally believe that to be together forever in the highest part of the celestial kingdom with my brother, with my aunts and uncles, with these people who have left our lives, my choices are like harming that. And so it's not that I walk forward in the world, who cares, I'm going to live my life. It's debilitating, it's paralyzing, it's depressing. I know a lot of kids who have left the church. It's one of the hardest things you can do. And as an anthropologist, the cases of people taking their entire culture, not just religious belief, but cultural, how they dress, what they eat, how they date, how they marry, how they raise a family, day-to-day decisions, that's what the church is. It's not just a religion.
the cases of someone taking this and shattering it and creating a new life are so rare. It rarely happens in the course of human history. And so what our generation of kids who are leaving are going through is such a strange cultural phenomenon that is enormously painful. And that's why I wanted to have this, is just to explain that side of it.
Thank you. Powerful.
Okay, so my story, first I was going to tell you a few of those things that Chelsea told you, but in this part instead of in the my background part. But like, this is my father's 100th birthday today. He's not alive, but this would be his 100th birthday today. And my dad was a great example with my mother, who was a non-member, of acceptance and love. He very much was always faithful in church, but my mother, who was a non-member, he never pressured her to join the church. And when my first two siblings were born, he took them to church every Sunday by himself. He never condemned my mother. He never said a rude word to her. He never even said, well, why aren't you coming? He just simply walked the walk and took my siblings to church. And he loved my mother, and he was completely accepting of my mother. And then when my third sibling was born and she died, my mother really had a struggle there, because she was a Christian, and in her faith, if a child died before they were baptized, they'd go to hell. And so my mother sort of fell apart when my sister died, and my dad was completely loving to her then too, but still he was not the one that kind of told her what our beliefs are about if a child dies, and about temple marriage and about those things. It was one of their mutual friends who told them. And through the course of this, my mother joined the church. So my dad was a great example to me, from what I would hear, of just acceptance and love and not trying to change somebody and just loving them to it. And so that I really appreciate my dad for that. My mom was also a really good example of loving and forgiveness and stuff. She told you the story of my son who died in an accident. Well, my brother who died in an accident when I was 15, my mother really was a super example of, it was my brother's friend that had accidentally killed him in an accident. And my mother, I saw my mother just put her arms around this boy and love him with no recriminations and show him absolutely unconditional love and no blame whatsoever. And when years later that happened to my son, similar deal, it wasn't his friend's fault, but he was with a friend when my son drowned in an accident, that I was able to completely do that same thing. And that the healing part of that, of having parents that were so accepting and loving, was a really great thing for me. So although I really tried in my parenting style, when I got married, my husband came from a much more religious background than I did. And I mean, he had kissed one other girl besides me, and it was a cousin.
Hey, it's not true confessions.
And I was not like that. So anyway, so when we got married, I really wanted to do better with my kids. And so like I had seen a couple of R-rated movies. This is a funny story, but when I married Eric, and I just determined that if I don't want my kids to do that, I can't do that as a parent. I don't care if I'm over 17 or whatever. I cannot try to teach my kids not to see R-rated movies if I see R-rated movies. So things like that. I tried to be very much more letter of the law than more gray area in my parenting style. And through the course of raising my children, I've had to sort of rethink that somewhat. And so the death of my son was a huge thing where, you know, I really had to come to grips with, you know, and even before, 6 weeks before the death of my son, my father-in-law, my husband's father, died. And I laid with my father-in-law on his bed the night he died, about an hour before he died. And I remember he was struggling to breathe and things. And I remember thinking, my father-in-law was a religious professor and had taught all his life about the plan of salvation and what happens when you die. And I remember laying beside him and just thinking, you know what's going to happen. You believed it all your life. Just let go and go. And so that, again, 6 weeks later, was a great comfort to me in the loss of my son, was thinking, he's with his grandfather. I believe this. I truly do. And coming to my core of thinking, you know, not just what I thought in the nether world, but do I really, really believe this? And I really found that I did. And so that was a super hard trial for me, but yet a real crystallizing of my faith in that moment. And the comfort that I got to trying to help my kids through that transition,
to try to just, you know, I had a 18-month-old at the time and a 4-year-old, and I did not have the option of just wallowing in bed in grief. I cried, and I felt that pain of that loss, but I had to just go forward because I had, you know, 7 other children that needed a mom, you know, and so that helped me sort of get through that time. But that when I talk about like the R-rated movies, just to show kind of my arc of change, there was a time, probably a decade ago, when one of my daughters was telling me, and they had said they had gone to an R-rated movie. This, we were at lunch, and I was with like 3 of them. And this one daughter said something, and by what she said, I knew that the movie she had seen was R-rated. And I literally started crying.
In a restaurant.
I just was so sad. I just felt like, oh my gosh, I have failed as a mom. I mean, I really truly felt that. I felt like I have failed as a mother, that I did not get across how critical this is to not see this R-rated movie, that they went and did that, even after I have never done that since I made that goal when I was first married. And I started crying, and they just kind of looked at me like, it's not that big of a thing, you know? And so years later, there were other things my kids did not tell me because of my reaction of bursting into tears over the R-rated movie. So I had to learn that I would rather know it all. I would rather my kids be able to tell me what's going on in their lives, even if it hurts me, even if I wish they weren't doing that, just because I want to know them, and I want to love them, and I want to support them, and I want to do those things. So that was a big journey of that little R-rated movie experience. Another one I'll give you, just when this topic of mutual respect, this is another one. I have a daughter that is an athlete, and she, for time and time again, would come to my home. And I had a young daughter, and she'd come to my home. She always wore what I perceived as immodest clothing, because it was always workout gear. And she'd wear these things, and I just say, I just don't wear that here. I've got a young daughter that I'm trying to teach to dress modestly, and you don't, and that's hard for me when you do that. And so I tried that and tried that and tried that, and she just always kept doing it, you know? And I loved her. I certainly not like I'd kick her out and say, well, you have to leave if you're not dressed that way. So, I mean, I never did do that. But I was finally one time I said to her, you know, you're an adult now. You're in college. She was in college at this time. I said, you're an adult now, and you're in college. So let's look at it this way. I said, if I went to your house and you, even though you're way younger than me and you're my daughter, if I did something in your house that you didn't want me to do and you said, Mom, this is my house, I would like you to respect me. Or if she had friends over or was doing something that, you know, whatever, that I was making an issue over and she said, it's my place, respect me, then I would do that. And I said, this is my house and I have a young daughter, and just if nothing else, out of you love me and I love you and we should respect each other, please don't dress like that here. If you dress like that everywhere else, I don't care. But please just don't here. And it was a changing moment because she just went into the other room and grabbed a t-shirt and put it on over what she was wearing. And since that time, I really haven't had that issue. So it was just a matter of sort of putting it in those terms of, and I even as your mother, if you asked something of me that you felt I was disrespecting you, I would try to do that. And so I expect you to do the same for me. And so that was a really a good moment for us. And there was times, many times in my life, when I have a sister who has 6 kids and they're all seemingly perfect in my eyes. And I've many times thought, why can't I be like my sister? Why did Heavenly Father not give my kids to my sister? Because then they would have all turned out perfectly. And I've actually verbally said that to my children. And one of my kids said to me one time, they said, you know, Heavenly Father gave us to you because you were the mom that we needed to have, you know, because, and that really helped me. And that's helped me a lot in these last few years of coming to that point of acceptance and of just loving my kids. I have a daughter, another daughter. So Chelsea, you've heard her story, but I have another daughter who's kind of struggling with her faith right now. And she very much went in, got married in the temple. She kind of straightened up her life. So she wasn't always a perfect kid, but she straightened up her life, got married in the temple, because she felt that Heavenly Father had really given her that answer that she was supposed to marry this boy. And she got married to this, and it was just a really hard marriage, and it didn't last very long. And she was just shattered by the feeling like she had been led astray by Heavenly Father, because she had been told that this she should marry this person, and it didn't work out. And as her mom, my heart broke for her, because I didn't want her to be unhappy. I didn't want her to, even though she was married in the temple, to be unhappy every day of her life. And yet I had those feelings of what a temple marriage is for me. And so, you know, and yet we all have agency. And so right now I'm kind of trying to get behind her choices and things that this has kind of thrown her off her path and things. And yet to just let her know, I understand and I love you and I will do everything I can for you. And, you know, my heart breaks for what you went through. And so anyway, I just think that I've just come to the point of realizing that as my kids age, many of them, they have verbally said this to me. My kids have said before, when I'll comment or try to still correct them, they'll, especially my 20-year-olds, they'll always say, Mom, you've already taught us. You did your job. We know it. We know all the things we are supposed to and not supposed to do, but now you just need to back off and let us live our lives and just love us, you know? And so that's been good for me, for them to verbally kind of check me and say, you know, because I'll think, well, maybe I missed that part, and that's why you're not doing that, you know. And they'll say, no, no, you got that part. We heard it. We heard it, but we just don't want to do it, you know. And so I have had to come to the point of realizing that I just have to let go, and I have to let them live their own journey and do their own thing of what they want to do. And I just want to...
And do you like that? Do you like that you have to do that, or that you've learned to do that? Is that in other words, has this been a blessing to have to do that, or is it still like...
No, I think it's been a blessing, because when I find... Well, so because I'll give you this other example. I have a son that was particularly hard in the last 4 or 5 years, and I found that if I tried to impose my will on him, it would completely always backfire. And so I really, really had to learn to let go with him. And that was a huge transition for me. So it is, I do like it in that it kind of takes the pressure off me, because it's not my choices. It's not my decisions. It's their decisions. And that's what we fought for, was free agency. And so even though I think that free agency should be imposed, but anyway, not really. But anyway, I think that, you know, that... But kids have agency, and I can now sort of let go and let them own their own choices and not take it on myself as I'm a terrible mother because my child is watching this R-rated movie. So it has helped that I can live with it better. But nonetheless, it still is hard for me because, like Chelsea said, that our church is not just a religion. It's your whole being. And I believe it with my whole being. And I live it with everything I am. And so to see my kids making these missteps is still incredibly difficult for me. And I still... I'm jealous of families that don't have that issue, that seemingly on the outside, everybody is going along. And I still once in a while catch myself thinking, we could have, would have, should have, what didn't we do, you know? But overall, it has helped.
Can I just real quick interject, just from the, again, just saying the perspective of the kid who leaves or has left. Hearing the story, I completely rationally understand it all. Emotionally, it feels like pinpricks. I don't know. I see a lot of kids nodding because I feel like here, in the world, people think I'm kind of smart and pretty accomplished. In my family, it's like, I am a failure. Yeah. Yeah. She wishes that I would have been in, like, I've heard her say, why didn't they turn out like this family? You know, like, and again, I get why she says it rationally, but we're just talking how we feel, which is, I hear these stories and I know I'm going to disappoint these people I love for the rest of my life. And it's not that I'm going to, you know, I still want to make my own choices, but every decision I make, I think, gosh, I have to outweigh, like, what I think or know or feel with, I don't want to hurt them. I wish my parents had kids that turned out the way they want. As I make my own choices, I'm like, gosh, I feel so bad for Heidi and Eric. Like, I want them to have the 8 kids and the million grandkids and the life that they wanted. And but hearing the story, it hurts. That's all.
But I have to interject that aside from church, which I know I didn't say this, but I am saying it now. Aside from church things, I try to tell my children constantly how proud I am of everything else that they are. I know they're fabulous human beings. I know that they're accomplished people. I know that they're smart. I know that they have done well in school. I know that they have much to offer the world. You know, so I do see that on every level, and I do try to verbalize that to my children that I am proud of all those things. But nonetheless, for me, that is still a huge thing. And so I still struggle with that because I think of all things in the world, that in my personal life is the most important almost, you know. So that is still hard. thing to resolve. Oh, I did want to say this one last thing. So as I read this, this was in this most recent conference, but this, I think, really explains how I feel. It's Elder Brent Nelson said, he told of the prodigal son, and this is his quote. He said, "The prodigal son informs his father that he wants his inheritance now. He wants to leave the safety of his home and family and seek after worldly pursuits." He said, "Please note that in the Savior's parable, the father lovingly responds by giving his son his inheritance. Certainly, the father must have done everything he could to convince the son to stay. However, once the adult son makes his choice, the wise father lets him go. The father then demonstrates sincere love, and he watches and waits." And I feel like that's the point I'm at now. I feel like the point I'm at now with my children that are struggling is just, I've taught them, I want to do everything I can, but I want to most of all just love them and watch and wait. And in my feelings, I still have hope that they'll come back to what I feel is important. But if they do or if they don't, I will always love them and be watching and waiting.
Thank you, Heidi. I think that's, in this room, that's a hard thing to share, isn't it, in some ways? We don't hear Heidi's very often, at least on my podcast and other things. And it's super, super important. I really appreciate that. Can I push your vulnerability a little bit more?
Sure.
Okay, and Eric, we're going to get to you, I promise. Okay. Do you think there's ever a time, and maybe Chelsea, maybe this is what the next 10 years is about, that if she's able to articulate it as not a loss and not as missteps, but as forward steps, can you ever see breaking open and saying, wow, this is bigger, this is richer, this is more compassionate, this is this, and could it ever not feel to you, can you imagine that at all, to not feel like misstep? Or they'll come back?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, I can see, I mean, I truly, you know, the biggest thing is love one another and love God as yourself. So, I mean, I love the compassion. I love those things. This is a kind of a funny example, but I mean, I watched the Bruce Jenner interview and was just so empathetic to him. I mean, I just thought my heart ached for him. I just thought, wow, that is really hard that people have to feel that way. So, I mean, I can have all the compassion in the world, and I love that she has that compassion and feels that way. But because of what my true belief system is, I just think that all that can be had still in the church. I think the church, mistakes or not, I still think it's the best thing out there, and I think that it's the truth, and that love and that acceptance and all those things can be had still within that, and I believe that is the end goal of life here on earth for me. So I don't know that I could ever get to the point of just thinking that's a completely valid and totally okay thing for my children to choose, because I would always kind of feel like I really just in my heart don't believe that. So I don't know.
And I think for some people hearing this, they'd be like, like being loved in an eventual state that you don't believe in is a hard thing, right? But I have to say, that doesn't cause me pain anymore, because we went from growing up in a house, and again, parents change, and it's been really good for me. This is why I always encourage people, take a long time, don't hurt yourself in the process, but it's been very good for me to see a mom cry over a rated R movie, right? To get to this point where I remember walking out to a rally for ordained women, and I had people staying at our house, and I was driving them, and I was leading this group of 500 on Temple Square. And, like, you know, they saw this thing happening, and someone asked my mom something, and she just said, "Oh, I don't know, that's just Chelsea. We love her anyway." And I had never heard that. For 30 years, I'd never heard that. And my parents, I think, are loving and kind, but they had such this pressure of raise your kids right, that I remember my dad and I debating unconditional love and getting quotes from Maxwell and Nielsen, and we had this big debate that the church does not believe in unconditional love, and me as a kid feeling, and trying to debate, like, I get it, I'm an academic, we can intellectually talk about the problem of evil, but do you understand the pain it causes to hear a parent tell you that, you know? And so to get to where we are today, for me to even hear, like, but we love them anyway, separates, in my mind, love from Mormonism. And that's never been separate.
And for the first time in literally as old as I am this year, in me making my own choices, I've weeded out the people who don't love me anyway. And I've kept those who support and love me close. And I finally, after this long, have learned the difference that, like, I can still be loved if I'm not Mormon. And I've been terrified of that.
Wonderful articulations.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.